I'm Brian, I'm an actor. Okay, hello everyone, and
sorry.
Alright.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry.
Thanks to the committee for inviting me along, and for Joe, co-speaker. just take a look. I got a lot of stuff queued up. As I invariably do, and but especially now, and I hope this goes better than the one I did in the bath earlier. It was a disaster. Yeah. Well, I think so. You there? Actually, that's better, right? That's better? Yeah?
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, well. Okay, the thing is, it was the last... Really, I loved using. I loved it. It really... it did something for me. It gave me a lot. But the last... If I'm really honest, the last 4 or 5 or 6 years, the drugs were taking a lot more than they were giving, and I was in a kind of in a hell, you know, and I couldn't stop, not for any period of time. I could stop 1 or 2 days, you know. I used to go to prison a lot. I used to detox. It was very kind of old-fashioned way of detoxing in prison, and just grit it out, and I used prison like that. I was quite happy to be in there, and I once got 6 months clean once in prison, but I could never bust loose. I could just never bust loose of myself. I could never shake off any kind of feeling of dread and anxiety. I couldn't grow. I was stuck. I was clean or abstinent, but I was very stuck. And mercifully, then I'd use again, and I'd forget about cleaning up for another year or another 6 months or another 2 years. But I wanted to get clean. I did. I knew that my life was more than what I was achieving, which wasn't much. No. It really wasn't much. I was sitting in a little cubicle in McDonald's, smoking some gear, thinking, I've arrived at last. This is it. I've cracked it. Not just achieving anything, not feeling anything, no esteem, I'd earned no esteem, and so I was permanently down. And of course, the only way I could survive was to just be completely arrogant, like I knew it all. And that's a tough place to be. For me, it was really tough, and it meant I never got to know anyone, I never got to know myself, and I just stuck in a bubble of no self-esteem, and I'm completely brilliant, and kind of go between that all the time. And I lived in this flat in the Queen's Crescent. It's like a squat, but it was a friend's flat. They'd moved up north, and I lived in it with my girlfriend, and we kind of embraced the whole kind of a druggy culture, and the kitchen was we painted it black, completely black, and there was just industrial sized bottles of methadone on a sink top, nothing in the fridge. I mean, I'm lying, nothing in the fridge. Not even, it was a big kitchen and we didn't, not even had a table and chair. You know, and I used to, well, I don't ever remember eating in the flat at all. I don't remember cooking one meal. So I just used to kind of hit up and then I'd be holding on to the surface of the sink in that kind of, that junky kind of downhill slalom kind of, you know, where, you, where your legs would buckle. And that would be, my night in. You know. It was not... you would expect the Velvet Underground to be in there or something. Or just trying to work out how to use the Breville or something. It was such a donkey kitchen, and the bedroom was black as well. We painted the, we must have had a load of black paint or something because we painted that. And my girlfriend at the time reminded, she lives a couple of doors away from me still, and she reminded me recently that we'd gone to sleep one night and we started to kiss. And this is God's honest truth, we woke up the next afternoon and we were still in a sort of kissing position. Just all our lips stuck together. And honestly, what I wouldn't give for a night's sleep like that now. I mean, I don't sleep a lot in recovery. And so that was it. And I had the old cronky car outside, and all the doors falling off. Bought tyres and no tax and no insurance. Bits of old wardrobes on tied up on the roof and trying to sell. And, you know, it was a Spartan. It was a really Spartan existence. And her ex-boyfriend came round one night, and the next thing I was on his motorbike and we'd gone to a meeting. And I had enough. More than, you know, I'd had enough. And I listened to what people were saying, and I kind of woke up. Exactly what you were saying. I woke up. I guess it was what you'd call like a near-life experience, you know. And because I was dead. And okay, so you know, the illness is quadraphonic or something, and you know, my wellness was a little tiny speaker, but you know, something clicked in that first meeting, and I thought, this is it, this is the way out for me, this is the way out. And I was full of joy. I left the meeting. I was dancing almost. And, I danced straight to the pub. As I think back to that first meeting, and I'd been presented with a solution, and I thought, "You are not going to control me. This is the program. Whoever you are, you're not going to control me with your." Whatever it is, your steps and your traditions and your sponsors and, you know, it's not, no one controls me. You know, and being the bane of my fucking life, that I wanted to be in control but take no responsibility. You know, that was me in a nutshell, you know. And, oh God, and the pro was saying, yeah, but you know, you can let go and take responsibility. You know, and I said, well, but you will not control me. And You know, and it's, I think it's something maybe a lot of us suffer from, that we don't like to be controlled. And, but the only thing was, I went to the pub and I had a beer, and then another 6 months went by. That's all. You know, and I said, God, how did I get back here again? And, you know, I went to another meeting and the same thing. You know, you won't control me, and the same thing. And I could see I was just getting caught in a similar pattern. And all right, so I went. I said, this is, I've had enough. I went to a meeting. I couldn't get clean, so I went. My mum got a caravan down in Kent. I went, you know, muggins here. I didn't even go to the treatment centre. I took a bag of Rohypnol, and I went and I did the Rohypnol shuffle, or whatever it's called, you know, cold turkey on my mum's caravan floor. And a couple of days I was all right. I was okay. And I said, I'm going to go back to meetings. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back to meetings. That's the thing for me. And I'm going to have a drink first. I'm going to go down the country pub. And I'm going to just, I don't know what I was going to do. You know, pretend I was some sort of gentleman drinker or something. I've no idea. All I just knew, I was in some kind of like self kind of weirdness. And you know, and I got the new white tennis shorts on and the white tennis shirt and the jumper over the thing. And I, you know, I'm 2 days off gear. I was a mess, you know, short of having a tennis racket under. And I'm in the country pub and I'm just bluffing it like mad. You know, still thinking I can pull it off. I can do it. I can pretend it. Anyone who's looking, I can pretend I'm really just fucking normal. You know. And, you know, and who am I kidding? And I left that half a beer or whatever it was. I just left it on the counter. And I tried to get back to my mum's caravan across a field, and I was feeling a little bit upset, and my stomach was a little bit weird, and I tried to jump over, I tried to vault over a fence, you know, like I was really, you know, on top of my game. And as I vaulted over, of course, you know, I evacuated myself in the new white shorts. And I sat there in all that mess, and I started to cry a little bit, and then I could not stop. And I don't think I'd cried since I was a kid, you know. I hadn't cried since someone sort of sold me a really moody £10 bag. That was the last time I really cried. Down in Soho, a bag of fucking coffee granules. And I still cooked it up and shot it up. And I knew it was coffee. And I still fucking shot it up. Anyway, it was the last time prior to that I'd cried, and I just was sitting there, and I cried my eyes out. And that was June the 19th, 1988, and I've not used since. That was my last user. That was then. So, yeah. Thank you. I'll have that. And so I came back to London, and that was it. And I hit the meetings, and I just didn't want to look back. That was all. I did it all. There was no more left in me. You ain't won't control me. I'm a rebel. There was none of it. It was gone, and I knew it had truly gone. And I knuckled in. There was going to be no. I don't know what it was I was expecting all my life, for someone to take care of me, or for someone to discover me, or something that was going to magically happen, that was going to transform me into somebody, you know, special, you know. I knew that I was going to have to do the work, you know, I just knew. And so I hit the meetings, and I went to, I must have gone to a meeting every day. I was shown to hear, sometimes two a day, sometimes on a Saturday, four meetings a day. And like that, and just meetings. And I knew I was safe, what Joe was saying, I knew I was safe, but I knew I was in trouble as well. I knew that I couldn't, if I didn't work on myself, I wouldn't stay safe. And I got a job almost immediately, you know, and with someone in a fellowship. And I hadn't worked for a long, long time. And my sponsor set me up, and he got me the job. And I spoke to a guy in recovery, and he said, "I'll see you at 8 in the morning." And I said, And I realised that he didn't mean like fucking 8 in the afternoon or something. He just meant 8 in the morning, you know. And so that was how I started. I started going to work, and I started coming to meetings in the evening. And maybe 6 months after that, I got offered a better job. And it's the first time I've been offered something like that in a long, 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 long time. And I had the balls to take it. You know, that's the thing. I had the courage to say, "Yeah, I'll have a go." You know, and I'd been a great one all my life. I'd been offered loads of stuff. People have always offered me loads of stuff, and I'd never. Always at the last minute, I always backed out. I'd always had an excuse, and I got into a relationship. 1 year and 1 day clean. We waited 1 year and the 1 day. I don't know if anyone's, you know, if you've ever spent years hating yourself, you know, because the thing that we had in common was that, you know, she didn't like me. And I didn't like me either, so, you know. But it was a good match, right? And of course I'd go to, and I was in trouble. I was in a relationship, and I was in trouble. I should not have really been in it. Should have been concentrating on myself. And the sponsor was saying, "Well, you know, we'll work it out, and we'll, you know." And then she got pregnant, and I was full of nothing but fear. I was working in Hackney. Years ago, I dropped out of my apprenticeship in Hackney, and I found myself all these years later right back where I dropped out, sort of high powerish or something. But I was in this relationship. It was not going anywhere. In fact, it was dangerous. It was dangerous for me to be in it. And we used to go to a little cafe on the corner with a workshop, just on the corner. And then that closed down. And then there was another cafe up Mare Street, Nightmare Street, I used to call it. You know, and Mandy's Kitchen. And I went up there for a lunch, and at that time, I think they're demolished now, but at that time there were maybe about 10 full-size windows, and I had to walk past every one of them to get to the kitchen. And this was every day, and I'd start off the first window, I couldn't resist it, and I looked in, ooh, you know, and I'd kind of, you know, who's that handsome devil, you know? Brad Pitt, isn't it? Or something, you know. Next window. This is all like really speeded up, but you know, next window. Are you having a fucking laugh? Brad who? You know. Next window, you Brad Pitiful, you know. Not like it. Next window, you know, the two sort of normal windows must have been boarded up or something, because I just went straight past them to, you know, into very quickly now, they're like, you're a fucking freak. That's what you are. You're a freak. You're the elephant man. You know? You're like, go on, piss off. You know, that combination of being completely self-obsessed and full of self-loathing and all that kind is a nightmare. And, you know, that kind of thought. And, you know, I would end up, and this was every day, I'd end up getting into sort of Mandy's kitchen and I thought, oh, you know, I'm not a monster, you know. I'm a human being, you know. And, two eggs and chips, please. You know, and after a while, then I had to phone my sponsor. I felt ridiculous, but I phoned him and I told him what was going on. I was expecting some really kind of mystical kind of answer, and he just said, well, you better go a different way. Why didn't I think of that? I was locked in to just this horrible stuff that I thought early recovery was about for me. It was not a great deal of joy. It was about kind of, it was quite painful. And I got by on a lot of support, but a lot of raw courage, you know. Raw courage. And after that, the sponsor, and then we did the step 4 and 5, and I started to like myself. I started to appreciate myself, and it was a very, very healing thing to do. And I split up, also very painful, but better. To be lonely on my own than to be lonely in a relationship, because it is just an awful place for me to be. And and we plugged on. I did a step 3 with him, and prior to that, we got to step 6. I got very lost. I didn't really know really what a defect was, or how a defect was working in me. Or I'll be honest with you, I wasn't entirely ready to have them removed. I wasn't entirely ready. You know, I was willing, and I was on my knees, and I was doing all the stuff, heartfelt stuff. But I wasn't entirely ready. And we moved on to step 7. And he said, we'll come back to that. It's not about trying to do this in some kind of chronological order or anything like this. It's about, you know, having a go. It's about having a go. And I wanted to pick up on what Joe was saying, because I strongly believe that while I've been in recovery, that it seems to me that my disease must have been doing some sort of university degree, because it's getting really fucking clever. And I'm kind of like, you know, I don't know what it's doing, you know, but it's a real, right clever thing. And so I got to around that time, 5 years into recovery, and I got really, really fed up. really fed up with the whole shenanigans. I just got really fed up with it. And I had a commitment, but I joined a spiritual group. And it was the answer for me. I was on my way to a meeting, and I saw this sign. There's a spirituality meeting in a hall, and I swerved over, and I went in there. And that was it. It was the answer for me. It was about spirituality. And I thought, you know, I'll get a big, big spiritual fix is what I'll get, you know. And I stopped going to meetings is the thing. Because I thought, well, that's no good for me anymore. Really, where I'm at now is kind of, you know, numerology and astrology and all these fucking things, you know. And I mean, you know, and I'm the sort of guy, I'd been barefoot over to India in the 70s, mugged off like a complete wally, you know, all that stuff. I'd already done it. And here I was in recovery, sort of repeating the same thing. And the same patterns coming up. And I joined a spiritual group. I went to meetings every night, and we'd burn all these mad incense, and up, you know, and I was really up there, you know, and I changed my name. I've not even called myself Brian for years. It took me fucking years to get that name back. When I came in, my sponsor said, "You own your own name. You own it. It's yours. You own it. It was given to you, you know, and you own it." Because I call myself all sorts of other stuff, you know, but never Brian. I didn't, and so, you know, and I came into recovery and I claimed my name back and I gave it away again, you know, and here I was, some other name, and not going to meetings. They said to me, if you've heard this before, I'm sorry, but they said to me, you know, you're a really well-intended guy, you know, you are spiritual, no doubt about it, but, you're a bit intense. You're a bit intense. Yeah. I said, well, I'm an addict, you know. I mean, it's what I do, you know. Yeah, they said, well, yeah, you know, but we're a spiritual group, you know. We don't do intense, you know. What you need, and by the way, they didn't believe in addiction, you know, of course. You know, they didn't believe in all that. So, you know, what you need is, every Friday night, religiously, you have a couple of pints of beer and you'll get it out of your system. Yeah, and I thought, yeah, well, that's a fucking brilliant idea. That is the answer that I have been looking for. Truly, I couldn't get the stuff about spirituality, if the truth, you know, in that respect. And I thought, you know, so what you do is you have a couple of beers on a Friday and you just vent it out of your system. And someone was giving me permission, you know. The guy, the cult leader, yeah, that's what you need to do, mate, you know. Yeah, well, that's, you know. And I arranged to meet some fellow spiritual people in a pub up in Hampstead to start my purging or whatever it was called, my venting, my venting, but what I'm saying is importantly is that the disease was there all the time. It was fucking there all the time. And if it couldn't get me in meetings, and it couldn't get me at work, it would get me in a spiritual situation, a pseudo spiritual situation, you know. And it was a wake up call for me, because, you know, I'd arranged to go to the pub and they called me up at somewhat 3 a.m. or something, or, you know, the fucking moon's in Pluto or something, and we've cancelled it, you know, So there's no pub meeting, and there's no... And I woke up again. I just woke up and I thought, this disease is very, very, very tricky. You know, it's a very tricky thing, and it's coming at me all the time. Sometimes silent, sometimes, you know, sometimes ninja, sometimes full on. But it's there. It's there, and it's real. It ain't some kind of, like, figment of our imagination. It ain't, you know, I think the disease of addiction is a real thing, you know, and it's going to kill me if I don't. Yeah. And I came back to meetings, and I've not stopped coming back to meetings since that day. And that was whenever that was. That was about 14 years ago or something. And I've come back with a renewed passion, and surprised me. It surprised me because I thought I'd got well, and I could outrun addiction, and I stopped from that day on even trying to figure out really where addiction came from, and I stopped reading all these books on what have you, and I just stopped trying to understand where it came from, and I came to the conclusion that if I had found out where addiction comes from, I would try to unaddict myself and use again. You know, that is the sole purpose of me trying to figure out what this is all about, which is just a big load of intellectual runaround, all geared up to get me using again, you know. But I can't beat it. I can't beat addiction. I can't. It's not something that I can... I can't outwit it, I can't outrun it, I can't outthink it. I can just be in a meeting and try to feel my way in, is what I was told, and that's what I believe. That I have to be here, and I have to feel my way in, and I have to be really, really gentle with myself, because I don't like myself much. On my own. If I'm on my own for too long, I turn in, and it's a terrible thing, really, because addicts are really inward-looking people, generally very inward-looking, and when I look in, I don't actually see a great deal of goodness. I just see all the horrible stuff. So I have to be looking for something greater than myself that's outside of myself. I really have to rely on the power greater than me, and get past myself. And try to and believe in God, basically. You know, for an inward-looking person, it's a difficult road. But I have found the God of my understanding. I have found it. And my brother, and he bumped into an old mate of mine from school, Teddy Barnes, and he bumped into him in a boozer recently. And Teddy goes, "God, what's happened to Brian? You know, he must come round for a drink round to wherever it was, the Crown and Anchor or something." My brother said, Teddy said he's found God. And Teddy said, maybe we'll cancel that. And we'll, I'll catch up with him another time. But in a nutshell, my brother's absolutely right. I have found God. I've found God in these rooms. Is what it is. I've found God in these rooms. And it has been the saving of me, you know. And it is the thing that has really woken me up. I don't want to be hanging around bruises. Or I don't want any of that life. I want a new life, you know. I want my new God-given life. You know, we love a story, eh? The facts of this are not true, but the actual message of it is 100% and in this story. And so, you know, Gordon Brown he wants to know how all these self-help groups are so successful, and he, you know, forms a little committee and he goes to meet them. And the first stop is Samaritans, there's a phone there, and yeah, and the Samaritan guy says, yeah, it's the phone to God, you know. And he, right, so he picks it up. He has a little chat with him, gets nervous, puts the phone down. He says to the Samaritan guy, yeah, how much do I owe you? You know, he says, well, you know, 30 seconds off the phone, 100 quid. You know, so very reasonable. Puts that down. Next stop on his mini tour of self-help groups in Oxfam or something like that. Same thing, he's in the office, phone, is that the phone? Yeah, that's the phone, like the God. Oh, come out, I say, woof, and he gets a little bit more confident, and he's talking with God, and 5 minutes goes, well, oh, I see you, God, see you later, you know. Puts the phone down, how much do I owe you? He says to the Oxfam guy, well, oh, he said, blimey. 5 minutes on the phone, he said, oh, it's about 500 quid. He said, no, it's very reasonable. And, next stop, ASC meeting, you know. And he's in there and he sees that there's a mobile phone there. He says to the spokesperson for NA, is that the... He said, yeah, that's the hotline to God, that is. Can I? Yeah, so he's on that phone. And I mean, honestly, he's burning God with... You know, he wants to know if his son's going to play for Scotland. He wants to know what's going to happen with all sorts of things. I mean, he is on that phone for over an hour. The battery's run out. He says to the NA guy, how much do I owe you? The guy says, we've been on it for an hour. He said, that's 12 quid. What? He said, that's cheap. How come? He said, it's a local call. And that has been my get out of jail, because God is a local call to me. That is a local call. And it's just wherever I want it, whenever I want it. And you know, and it's always, God is always nearby. And I can always tap into it, always. And I would not, there was no way would I have got that if I had not come to meetings. This has been the real salvation for me, and the real second chance. And I wanted to, because I was nervous before coming to do this, and I'm trying to emigrate to Canada and get a new life, and you know, and I'm in St. Trafalgar Square, and I was having a cup of coffee, and I was sitting right in front of Canada House, and it was big gold letters, you know, CANADA, Canada, right over in the portico, and I said a little prayer that, because I've sent off the applications, and I thought, Christ, right in the middle of C-A-N-A-D, it's right in the middle of Canada, is N-A, and I thought, yeah, now that to me makes sense for me, that makes sense for me, because if I get, and God willing I do, I will be right in the middle of it, like I'm right in the middle of it here. And it's going to save me here, and it's going to save me there. And, you know, as long as I stay in the middle, yeah, I'm safe, and I'm growing, and I'm grateful, and thank you.